Yo, I'm Eric Torenberg. Welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Anne Friedman. Anne is a journalist who does a lot of stuff. She has a weekly column in New York Magazine where she writes about gender, tech, politics, social issues. She also has a podcast, Call Your Girlfriend, which is great. She runs with her best friend, Aminatou Sow. And this episode, we talk about a lot of things. How to be a journalist in 2015, how she builds and maintains a relationship with her audience, how her podcast with her best friend has affected her relationship with her best friend, and what it means to be an ethical tech consumer. This is a fun, fun episode. All right, here's it. There's so many things that you do. I'm curious, when people ask you, what do? How do you even respond?
It's funny you should ask this because I don't think I can really talk about it yet, but I've spent some time reporting on an article that sort of gets at this how you talk about what you do question, and I am uniquely bad at it. I usually say I'm a writer, although in Los Angeles, you tend to have to qualify that with I'm a journalist or I'm a freelance writer for magazines, so people don't think you're an aspiring screenwriter. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, my general approach is to say I'm a journalist or I'm a writer, and then if people ask more questions like what do you write about or you know, for whom, then I just start listing all of the things that I do and their eyes glaze over quickly. And I don't really have like a coherent narrative about like what my career is all about. I should probably get one.
You know, you obviously write, you have a podcast, Call Your Girlfriend, which is fantastic. You speak, you consult, you've had various different types of positions. Is there a certain arc that ties things together or do you have a cross to bear, so to speak? Are there certain things that you're really trying to get at or trying to do or trying to achieve?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I definitely have had a point of view throughout my career. I'm not like I was never an unbiased newspaper reporter or someone who sort of strictly reported the news. I don't know. I mean, the first line of my Wikipedia page, which someone else wrote, obviously identifies me as a feminist writer, which is certainly true. I think that the set of things that I write about has changed somewhat, but that's definitely a through line. And
you don't want to be boxed in as just that.
I don't know. I don't find it to be the world's most oppressive box to say, like, I'm a feminist writer. Like, I actually think feminism is pretty broad and encompasses a lot, but it's probably not accurate. I mean, there's a lot of things I write that, you know, while I write everything as a feminist, because I am a feminist, it's not like, you know, I have quite a bit of work where you would never read it and say, huh, I've just read a piece of feminist writing. You know, I mean, it's not like an easy term to apply. I would say that almost everything I write is about gender, politics, culture, technology. Like those are like the big four broad categories. And often things I write are at the intersection of those four things. But again, like, you know, what is culture? That's the world's biggest term. And, you know, gender is also a broader concept than just feminism. And so in some ways it's a cop-out to say these are four broad ways of talking about my work. But yeah.
Talk about how the podcast evolved. You know, you with a super close friend, Call Your Girlfriend. How did that come about, and what's most surprised you since doing it?
Well, there's a third person who is equally important to Call Your Girlfriend, who is our producer, Gina Delvac, who has a lot of public radio experience. And she had said to us, you know, you guys should think about starting a podcast. And it's something that definitely both Amina and I wanted to learn how to do, both from a technical perspective, but also just because I think we had a sense that the sort of podcast we would make is not something that we were familiar with as already existing. I know more about podcasts now. I don't think I was a huge podcast listener before we started. And so I would say that there are many shows, both created before and after we started our show, that that are kind of in a similar vein. You know, like they tackle certain topics. They kind of have the same tone of humor, you know, punctuated with serious commentary on things. But you know, I mean, for us, it almost started as an experiment and as a challenge. And it has been really, really fun, mostly. There have been some technical frustrations, and there are definitely some weeks when we are both exhausted from doing our jobs and don't feel like getting on the phone and talking for it to be recorded and broadcast. Sometimes I don't feel like I'm at my smartest or funniest, but there is something to be said for the practice of just continuing to do it, you know, not making three episodes and then quitting, or not, you know, creating an episode whenever we kind of get around to it, but, you know, sticking to a serious schedule. And I think that is a real way you build an audience for something, is to sort of say, this is where you find it every other week, always. And we've been pretty good about that, which I'm proud of.
Building an audience, let's talk about that for a bit. First of all, how is your audience in podcasting, how do you think about that differently than you do from your writing?
I mean, the audience in podcasting is way bigger. I think of any individual podcast as probably, maybe not more than any article I write, but I think the average thing I write reaches fewer people than the average podcast episode we do. The other thing is that podcasting is an incredibly intimate medium. People's voices are in your ears, and I think that it creates a very, I don't know. I mean, intimate is sort of an overused word in this, but yeah, it definitely creates a special relationship with the people who listen, because they're like making dinner or they're commuting or they're sort of going about their daily lives while they're listening to us. It almost is like we're part of what they're doing. And we got a letter from a woman who was like, I'm new, I just moved, and I don't have any friends in my new city yet. I've just been unpacking my apartment and listening to your podcast. And I know this sounds weird, but you guys feel like my only new friends in this town. And we were both like, oh, like, you know, and I get nice emails about my writing, definitely. And I feel like there are many things I've written that have resonated with people, but the podcast is just on another level altogether in terms of what it can do to foster that connection. And so I am really grateful for that. And I think it's one of the coolest things about this medium that we're using right now.
You know, it's interesting. You've understood as a journalist that, you know, it's not just about writing, you know, amazing things. It's also about building and really connecting with an audience after that piece is out or in different ways. When did that really hit home for you? And how have you continued to explore and think about that?
Well, my first home on the internet was writing for a blog called Feministing, which was incredibly community oriented. And it was written by a group of people who shared responsibilities and kind of shared a similar worldview. But, you know, we obviously had our differences. And you know, it was sort of an era of blogs, like 2004. I mean, the site is still going for sure, but I wrote for it from 2004 to 2010, which was an era when I think community on a blog especially was really powerful. So I've always been aware of that. And you know, and that's actually probably a great example of how I don't really see it as I write a thing and then I find an audience for it. Like, I really think that the conversations that we have on the podcast, or that I have with people on Twitter, or that happen with friends over email, or that happen, you know, any number of places I exist making media, and I count that as everything from the podcast to a comment on a Facebook wall or something. All of that is part of the same dialogue that much of my writing is part of. So I don't really, it's weird to sort of say it's like writing and then looking for an audience for something. I think there's more of an ongoing conversation. I do sometimes feel like I have to find an audience among editors for an idea. You know, there's a lot of ideas I have where I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's going to take quite a bit of time, or it's going to take enough reporting that I have to get paid a decent amount for it, which means I need to have an editor who agrees with me that this is a cool idea before I can do it. And that's really an audience that I more think about as actively cultivating than I do about, say, readers, who I don't really think about that, like how to you know, build a readership for something. I did think about that when I was an editor, but as a writer, I think more about how to cultivate editors.
Interesting. I mean, some journalists would have something, would say something like, they're resigning themselves to, okay, I got to do this, you know, quote unquote marketing for the thing that I wrote, but you see it as something that's integrated in the writing itself, like in the communication with the reader itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's definitely how I think about my weekly column at New York Magazine for sure. I think that there are other things that I write that fit that. Of course, there are other articles that I'm sort of like, this is a weird thing I came up with on my own in isolation off the internet. But I would say that that is an exception. And I'm constantly, I mean, not just in dialogue with people who are reading, but with other journalists and, you know, with other writers. And I do think that the process of consuming media and talking about the things that I read and see is 100% integrated with how I write and what I choose to write about. Like, it's all, I don't even know if I would describe it as a linear process. It's like all a big salad of stuff. Yeah.
Felix Salmon had a piece a few months ago that people got really crazy about. It was something like, don't be a journalist.
Right.
You saw this piece?
I do recall this, yeah.
whereas your career kind of attests to, no, maybe just the role of a journalist is evolving or looks a little different than it used to.
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting. So I don't know exactly how old Felix is, but I have been a journalist for 10 years, which, in that article, he said that he could attribute most of his career success to being kind of at the, you know, in the right place at the right moment, both in terms of meeting people, but also in terms of, like I just mentioned, blogging in an era when blogs were something different than they are today. And I think that's definitely true of my career. I mean, I think that I started working as a journalist in this sweet spot where I had never known the old regime. Like, I'd never really knew a pre-digital, you know, world of journalism. However, I still started my career early enough that, like, by the time Twitter became something that all journalists use, I was a few years into my career already. So I was like, you know, I was a very early adopter of a lot of pretty powerful, what is now pretty powerful social media. And so I feel like I've gotten lucky on the timing front for sure. And I think this is part of what Felix was saying, which is that in order to break in today, things are a little different. Where I disagree with him is I think that there are probably opportunities that I am now missing because I'm rapidly becoming more establishment than I was when I started, that like younger or more up and coming journalists can probably take advantage of.
How so?
I don't know. I mean, like I have sort of like a casual usage of something like Snapchat, but I don't use that in a way where I'm like, like what is a really interesting way for me to integrate this into how I do my job? Or I'm not really inspired by that as like an interesting platform for conveying the ideas I have. Whereas, you know, for some other people, clearly many of them younger than me, but not all, some like platforms like that are like where they might find inspiration or might say like, it's crazy to me that no journalists are using this in the way that I am. And I don't have like a lot of, I mean, maybe it's not about the technology. Maybe it's about, you know, tone or the way you're using certain things. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I think about adopting blogs and social media, but I also think about things like using GIFs or recognizing that things that are handwritten connect with people in a different way, or the fact that we started a podcast before Serial, which is something I'll always be able to say. you know, like there are probably lots of examples of stuff like that, that, you know, I'm not going to be on the, you know, the leading edge of this forever. I think there are going to be other people who pick up on, hey, this is a thing that I should use professionally before I do. I mean, hopefully I'm wrong. Hopefully I sort of continue to evolve. But the sad thing about that piece of Felix's is that it sort of read to me like, oh, I could never, like, A, I won't continue to change and evolve as a journalist. And I was like, well, that's a bummer. Don't sell yourself short. But it also seemed to sort of not acknowledge that maybe other opportunities, in terms of ways to make a name or differentiate yourself would present themselves in the future. I think the economics of this profession, just from talking to people who were, say, freelance writers in different eras are totally, you know, tougher than they were in the past. But, you know, I never worked in that era. I never was a freelance writer in an era when you could get $2 to $3 a word for everything you wrote. So that's not how I work. And I can imagine how the environment today would feel super difficult if you were used to making that much more money per word, for example. I don't know. I think he's wrong, but I think that there are some, you know, grains of truth in that piece that he wrote.
When you see, you know, a piece by a VC, you know, about a tech VC saying that they're like super excited about the future of news or future of journalism, do you roll your eyes and say that, you know, mostly they don't get it? Or it's just interesting how the world of tech is kind of getting a foothold in modern kind of journalism. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think that, I think if you are aggregating media, you could maybe see the kind of growth that VCs like to see. I think that if you are paying for original stuff, it is very, very hard to have a media company with the kind of impressive growth that tech folks like to see. I think that by and large, you can make money doing original, like, you know, original content, doing really quality original media. But it's, the margins are never going to be huge. The growth is never going to be that like hockey stick style impressive. Oh my God. You know, that's the kind of stuff you get with like sharing and aggregation and like highlighting the best blah blah. Like, you know, and I don't have a problem with aggregation. In some ways, my weekly newsletter is that. But I think that when you talk about people with a tech mentality getting into media, my question is like, what sort of return are you expecting? Are you doing this because you want to put great stuff into the world, or are you doing this because you want to grow super, super fast and get super rich? Because one of those things is possible. One of them, I don't think is.
Do you put BuzzFeed and Vice in kind of the aggregation part?
I don't. I mean, I think that with both BuzzFeed and Vice, I'm sort of watching the long game. I think that they are both examples of producing valuable original content and doing some of the sort of aggregation we talked about before, while also having this agency model of creating stuff directly for sponsors. That is working really well right now. Whether and how long that kind of stays in this perfect balance, I will be curious to see. I'm not like inherently skeptical that it can. Maybe it can. But I just don't know. I think that that's like something a little bit different. I think a lot of the media startups that I see aren't actively trying to emulate BuzzFeed or Vice. They're really trying to do more of an aggregation type thing. But they're called a media startup, you know, for various reasons. But really it's not, I don't know. It's not like you're really trying to start a digital version of a magazine or something in most cases.
Right. And it'd be interesting to see, and then the New Republic, of course, too, everything that happened there, it would be interesting to follow, you know, these companies are hoping for huge returns and have investments under the expectation of traditional tech style, you know, growth and returns. It'd be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, if you are someone who has a lot of money to invest and you kind of have that tech mentality, it's like, you almost have to think of it as like, this is the thing that will, you know, be my legacy or make my name in a prestige way, like not in a money way, you know, like you need like, God, dare I say it, like a modern techie William Randolph Hearst type who is like, I'm doing this purely because I think I'm an important person and I want to be in charge of this media empire that's very influential, as opposed to I don't know. That's a bad example, because back then you could get rich making media, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But I think that there has to be more of this sort of somewhere between almost like a charitable attitude and sort of an influence desire, as opposed to a money making and quick return.
Well, it seemed that Chris Hughes had seemed like he might be that person for a bit, because he's made all the money he needs with Facebook. What's your stance on that?
I mean, my stance on that is that everybody likes to say they are in the former camp. So like, I just really care about valuable, you know, news and great reporting, and really smart analysis. And then you get a couple of years into the red because, like, before any media company is going to make any money back to be even just break even, it's going to be a while. And you realize, oh God, it's really expensive to do that. And suddenly the tide starts turning. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what Chris Hughes's personal finances look like. And I don't know. I have worked, though, for people who definitely were not did not make their money in the way that Chris Hughes did, but kind of had that mentality. And I would say that for me, and this is, you know, the same is true for the business models of Vice and BuzzFeed, is let me see how it pans out in 5 to 10 years. Even just 5 years, actually, I would be happy with like a consistent message on wanting to support quality journalism from someone with tech money for 5 years. Like that would be like, I would be, you know, interested in other examples like that.
Yeah. And it's interesting because in tech journalism, there's often the critique that a lot of the tech VCs have invested in the platforms. And so right. How honest or what, you know, obvious conflict of interest there.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely see why it's appealing to invest in a platform rather than, you know, like paying people like me to do original reporting. I 100% understand that. Like, you know, does that mean I think you're making a choice that's great for society? No. Does that mean I think you're making a change the world choice? No. But that's understandable. Making money is always an understandable motivation.
I'm curious to talk a little bit about the, you know, the concept of personal brand, but also just living in public. And a lot of this is also is just personally driven in the context that Product Hunt has gotten pretty popular in the last year, and there's just more of an audience, and that's had a little bit of an adjustment. I'm curious for you when your audience started to really, really grow, and how that, if at all, affected your personal life, and if you know, strive to make, is there like set limits between, you know, this is Anne Friedman, you know, I'm on the internet, but now I'm, you know, trying to do something else, or, and there's a lot of questions, but how do you think about this?
I don't know. I think I'm a bit like you, where I'm still trying to figure it all out. I definitely don't feel like I live my whole life in public or something like that. I think that I talk about what I think about the world a lot. I mean, I think most of the time, if you were like, huh, what does Anne think about insert issue here? You could probably Google and find an answer. And in that way, you know, the whole never running for office test. I think that I think pretty publicly, I guess. I don't really feel like I live publicly in a way that, that a lot of, I don't know, in the way that you're sort of alluding to.
Well, you talk to your best friend and it's recorded.
Yeah, but you know, do you know like what the best thing to happen to me over the last 3 months was? Or do you know the last time I had a fight with someone? Do you know like, you know, what I, you know, I don't know. Like we definitely do, you know, we share at the beginning of the podcast a few comments about, you know, physically where each of us is calling in from, whether we're at home or on the road. And we sort of, you know, maybe there's an anecdote about something that has happened in our lives, but it's really, I actually don't think that in terms of the podcast, we're super personally revealing. At least I don't really say anything that I wouldn't feel comfortable writing about in a column, which I would say that my threshold is for sort of saying something in public is different than, say, a person who, you know, like a friend of mine who's a teacher who, you know, maybe uses Facebook, but like doesn't really say anything about her life on the internet. I definitely say more than her, but I think that like if you were to give a quiz to people, even people who I would say follow the bulk of my work, about like what's really eating me up inside right now and like what has been my happiest moment lately and the kind of stuff that is, I mean, real life, the kind of things my closest friends would know, I'm not sure that there would be a ton of insights that the people who follow my work could give you. So I don't know. I mean, and that's kind of a weird nebulous answer. I don't feel like I need to protect my personal life too much, but I do make choices about, okay, maybe personally it's not time for me to write about that yet because I'm still figuring out how I feel about it. That would be a good example.
Was that a learned behavior? You know, meaning did you share, you know, too much at one point and then feel, oh, I got to back off, or just from the beginning you've had a good balance of, you know, this is what I should, you know, write about or talk about, and this is what's for my private life?
I don't know. I mean, I'm very careful about, I try to be careful about writing things that have to do with other people in my personal life, especially if those people are not the kind who are on the internet frequently, or like, you know, like the aforementioned friend who's a teacher. You know, I wouldn't throw out a bunch of details about a private conversation that we'd had without explicitly asking her first. I try to be careful about outing details about the people who are close to me who may not be choosing to do that. I mean, it's one thing for me to make that choice, but it's another for other people. And so, you know, that's something I think about for sure. But there's never been an incident that I've sort of thought, oh my God, I've said too much, or, I don't know. I'm struggling. I wish I had an answer for you about some dramatic event, but I don't really at all.
On the podcast front, has having a branded friendship affected the friendship at all?
I mean, it is a weird thing. I mean, the other day Amina said something to me. We were talking about something that someone had tweeted that was like, oh my God, Anne and Amina will love this. And we were like, oh my God, we hate that. Just the sort of thing I was talking about earlier, where there's this perception of intimacy between, you know, the two of us and strangers, where, you know, sometimes when people have that feeling about a public figure or a pseudo public figure or a stranger whose work that they know, it's easy to project, I like these people, and so these people will like what I like. and so I don't really mind if someone is like, you guys will love this, and it's a thing that I don't actually love. I'm kind of like, okay, you know, like that doesn't harm me too much for someone else to think that I love something that I don't. I didn't, you know, go out of my way to correct this person. But like, you know, it is a funny thing where people, part of the appeal of the podcast is this feeling of listening in to a private conversation between two people. And it is a private conversation, but like I said, it's not always a personal conversation. And so that little distinction is what makes it not truly a public friendship. Not that we're lying or anything, but you know, it's just like there's a distinction there, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. Professionally, as you look at the different things you do as career goal-wise, is it something where you just want to do what you keep doing, but just continue to, you know, get better at it and grow your audience with that? Or do you kind of have, you know, other ambitious goals, whether it's, you know, to write a novel or a screenplay or whatever? How do you think about your career, you know, big picture wise?
Well, growing an audience for my work is not a goal that I really have. I mean, I hope that the things that I make and do always resonate with people, but you know, if you told me, if you like read me the stats about our podcast and they were like, and it was something like, okay, only half the people who, you know, these podcast numbers are notoriously fishy, which is why I kind of use this as an example. But, you know, say, you know, that listenership is half of what you thought it was, but the half that is really there is so there for you guys. Like I'm all about that. Like, give me a smaller group of dedicated people. And that's more important to me. And I think that I already feel like there are people listening and conversing with me when I write something. So on the audience front, like I don't really have growth goals or whatever. That might be different if I were an editor. Editors kind of have to think about that stuff. But as a writer, I don't really have to. I do think that I have a lot of questions about my time and trying to be a little bit. I get very excited about all kinds of opportunities and to say yes to lots and lots of different things. And then at the end of the week go, oh my God, I did so many different things, but what did this week add up to? I don't know. and so, yeah, so I think that my goals have to do with, being a little bit more self-directed and saying, okay, what are five important things I want to write about this year? Instead of going into my year just being like, I'm going to make a bunch of cool stuff, which is kind of how I've approached my career to this point. And being a little bit more goal oriented, which is a lot harder than it sounds. I am in a very lucky position to have a lot of different, you know, weird and not weird opportunities to get paid to do stuff and to be a journalist in lots of different ways. But I'm always thinking about what is, I don't know. I'm thinking now about maybe how to hone that a little bit, or to ask questions about goals and how does it all add up. So I don't know. I think about this a lot, just not in the audience way.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think it's interesting. You've, you know, in the long form podcast, you were talking about how you've thought about in terms of network wise, not just looking up, but looking sideways and looking down. And it seems that you've kind of just had a good sense of, in the good way, of kind of the realities of what it takes to get your workout to people. Talk a little bit more about looking sideways, looking down in terms of, you know, building your network. And is this something that you've kind of resigned yourself to, or something you've, you know, been excited about?
Oh, I mean, I would not say I'm resigned to it. Like, it's something that I'm excited about. I always feel a little bit weird when I meet or like have a coffee with or trade emails with a journalist or a writer who I kind of consider to be like 8 to 10 to 20 steps ahead of me. I'm being super weird, and I don't know if I'm even asking you things that are useful to me. And whereas when I talk to people who are sort of a few years behind me in their careers, or who are doing slightly different things, or who are my peers, I find that I have tons of questions, and I'm really curious about like how they're muddling through this weird business. And I actually both want to share the knowledge that I have, because at the end of the day, this is still a pretty closed door profession for people with some degree of financial and social advantage. And I have a commitment to trying to break some of that down. But also I just like talking to people who are at a different place in their careers than me. So I don't know. I mean, I think it is in the long term a smarter choice. Don't get me wrong. I think I'm very aware that a lot of the places I write for, particularly the places focused on women, that once you pass a certain age, the personal experience card is like not that valuable anymore. I mean, when's the last time there was an essay on The Cut about being a woman in your 50s or something? Like, I sort of recognize that once you age out of an advertising valuable demographic, you have to find other ways to bring value. And that's like a horrible thing. Obviously, like, I'm a feminist. I don't want to live in a world where anyone ages out of public relevance because advertisers no longer care about them. But understanding that, and understanding that like the way my career works today is not the way it will always work, is also something that motivates me. And I say it all the time when I email journalists who ask for my opinion on something, or, you know, or introduce themselves. I mean, I say it all the time, just like, remember me when you have a cool job. And I'm like, no one wants to employ a 65-year-old woman writing a personal essay about her love life or whatever. You know, I think that's
real. You're doing Call Your Grandma. That's the next podcast.
I would, P.S., if any grandmas are listening, I would definitely listen to a podcast called Call Your Grandma, and would absolutely and help support any woman who wants to get that made. Just putting that out there.
Yeah, I'm sure any one of the many grandmothers that listen in will take this on. I would love to listen to that too.
Does your grandma listen? Maybe you should make this happen.
My grandma, her English is not that great. Oh man, I don't want to ask my grandma, but she definitely doesn't listen.
Okay.
That's a great idea. Grandmothers really don't get. I mean, that's the whole big criticism of people in tech, is that they only build stuff for themselves.
Oh yeah, it's super obnoxious. Like, I mean, even though grandmas could totally use like a food delivery service, you know, it's funny. I actually have a friend who, I'm from Iowa, and she lives not far from where I grew up, and she was having some health problems. And I was like, no problem. I'm going to get some groceries sent over to you right away. And I couldn't do it. Like, actually, it's not possible unless you live in like, you know, a major / coastal city to take advantage of a lot of the apps that are, you know, that are supposedly making life better for everyone. And so that was a real annoying experience maybe Call Your Grandma will address.
Yeah, I just heard of something. Someone was telling me about a startup that was something, they described it like Uber for nursing homes. I have no idea what that means. but it will be, I mean, there are lots of audiences that are, ignored by the 20-somethings or whatever, or 30, that are building these products. So it's interesting. I mean, and let's talk about that. You've written a lot about women in tech. And, you know, we have a very startup audience listening in, mostly male. What do you want startup bros to know?
I mean, I think that it wouldn't hurt. I mean, I actually don't know. I mean, I don't know as much as I probably could or should about what gets funded and how it's pitched. I mean, I think it's kind of just a huge casino. That's like my perception. It's not like the thing that is most valuable or that there's actually a biggest market need for is what ends up getting funded. So in some ways, like this whole conversation is theoretical. But, you know, I'm really interested in the notion of, okay, well, we have these apps that we know work in these big coastal cities. They're the ones that get referenced over and over and over. How do we make those work in other places? Or how do we get like a similar result if without the density of a big city? Or, you know, questions that kind of go beyond just how can we make another, you know, healthy fast food delivery app for people who live in San Francisco and never learned to cook and whose moms have stopped sending care packages. I think that like a little bit, I mean, obviously I'm biased toward my own profession, but a little bit of a reporting mindset about what needs truly are. I mean, Mother Jones editor Clara Jeffrey tweeted something about ideas for apps for parents. And this is a while ago now, not even in the past year probably, but I remember looking at the responses on her timeline and just being, I mean, I don't have kids, so it's not something I think about, but just being agog at like all of these ideas people had. And I was like, that doesn't exist, but we have like six, like we have like Uber for swim trunks and like, you know, like a million different random tiny things that don't seem that consequential. And you like can't rate babysitters or whatever it was people were suggesting. So I do think that a little bit of like, you know, market research is almost like you're too far down a path at that point. But like, even on a basic level, employing a little bit of a journalistic mentality and asking questions about what people need that technology could actually solve.
You mean besides Uber for helicopters or private planes?
Right, exactly. Uber for drones is actually my startup, so you can't take that. But yeah, I don't know, just asking some better questions and, you know, and assuming that your user base is not going to all be like you, like assume, you know, make a friend who is very different than you and ask them if they would use the thing that you're interested in using. Like maybe that's like a real way to boil it down. I have a friend here who's 88 years old, 80 something years old. And like, you know, and has an iPhone and is like, yeah, I'll probably get around to setting up Uber. I just prefer to call taxis. But like, I'm sure if I interviewed her about like what she actually wants that phone to do, she would have fascinating answers. I haven't because I'm not looking to, you know, launch a startup or anything. But maybe if I were, Uber for grandmas would be up there.
This whole Call Your Grandma podcast is sounding more and more important and interesting.
We're talking about the future advertisers for Call Your Grandma, actually. That's what the conversation is about. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm looking at, on Product Hunt, we have a whole list of Uber for X that people have built.
Oh, God, no.
I know. Push for Pizza. There's Uber for Pizza, which is, that's pretty compelling.
Yeah, but like, isn't there Uber Food? Isn't there already Uber for Pizza and it's called Uber Food and it's annoying me when I try to, anyway.
No, I'm with you. Let's play, overrated, underrated.
Okay.
Well, and first, let's actually start with Uber, because I mean the critique. Well, actually, I'll just let you talk. What do you think about Uber?
I mean, I use Uber, and I feel kind of guilty about it sometimes. I have an ongoing fight with someone in my personal life about fight is a strong word, but about like the end game for Uber and whether it's terrible for society or not. And I come down on the whole, you know, it's. Not the sharing economy. It's like the decentralized employment economy and the, without some, you know, major shakeups or like a revitalization of the labor movement, the end game is tough for all of us. And Uber is just a part of that. But that said, Uber has also totally revolutionized life in Los Angeles and I take it. So I feel very conflicted.
Yeah. The end game is interesting when you talk about like self-driving cars and what that means for, I don't even know if you guys talked about that in the calculus of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for right now, assume, you know, like people being able to make money on their time is very intriguing.
It is. But, you know, what I mean, with all things, I just wish there were more transparency. I mean, I'm sort of like, I would love to know when I take an Uber. I mean, and there are ways to figure this out, but even it's not totally transparent to the drivers, even how much they're going to make when they turn on their phone to sign on for a shift at Uber. Like I would love to see for passengers as well. Like, okay, I just took a $4 Uber. The person who drove me in that $4, you know, on that $4 ride made $2 for 15 minutes of work. And then I can know what I'm truly complicit in. it's like in a weird way, it's like the cut that Uber takes is not always clear to me as someone who's taking it, and being able to kind of say, all right, you know, maybe I should start tipping. That's another thing. You know, Uber used to say in the app, you know, we don't tip, and that sort of, that thing has gone away. But is that because, you know, they just decided everyone understands how it works now, or is it now totally kosher to tip drivers and I should be tipping the same way I would be tipping, you know, the person who gets me coffee at the coffee shop? I don't know. You know, these are just some, I have some sort of questions about how to be a more ethical consumer of Uber before they all become self-driving cars and everyone's out of a job.
It's interesting. I asked this to Kevin Kelly, who's a tech futurist, about like what happens when all the robots come to our jobs. And he goes, oh, we'll just keep thinking of new things for robots. I was like, oh, okay. I didn't really understand it.
Right. Which makes sense if you're the kind of person who has got the sort of technical know-how and the degree and the connections to be the person who thinks of new jobs for robots. And if you are part of the, you know, what is at this point, a pretty permanent lower middle class where there's no mobility to become that person who is just replaced, that calculus probably looks different.
Do you think it's very difficult, even with all the tools out there and, you know, mostly free or many of them free, to become a technically educated person?
Yes. I think that there's, I mean, the data about, you know, social and class mobility in the United States, even in recent history with the advent of technology, would say that the fact that it exists does not mean everyone has the ability to use it or utilize it the same way. Like, you know, I obviously, like a lot of people who, I mean, I grew up and I probably had the internet by the time I was in high school. But it was really slow and it was really expensive. And, you know, essentially not till college did I really become someone who used the internet. And so there's this very clear before and after. And I like to play the thought experiment of what if I had the internet as a teenager and preteen in the way that it exists now. I love thinking about that. But I'm not sure. I think for someone like me who had pretty educated parents and like from a very young age assumed I would go to college and had financial help to do that. And then from there, you know, had some means to get internships and then to start my career. That's not the case for everyone. And I'm not sure that access to the internet is the way, you know, is the leveler that it is sort of was promised to be for everyone. And I think that data about, income and debt and college attendance and all kinds of other things would prove that to be true. The power of sort of the social environment in which you grow up is strong.
Your point about knowing exactly what you're complicit in or, you know, knowing how you're affecting the driver's life and how much Uber's taking in. And
yeah.
That, you know, that data is there. It'd be very interesting if startups, you know, gave that data to consumers so they can know, just have a better sense of where they play.
Oh my God. I 100%. I think about this all the time with Spotify, which is I try to do this thing where if I notice I've been listening to an album a lot, I will buy it in some format. If I haven't bought tickets to see this person or whatever, I will try to make a financial investment in the artist if I've listened to more than like, you know, one song in passing. But wouldn't it be great if Spotify was like, hey, Anne, you've listened to this new Miguel album 50 times in the past week. Why don't you buy the album like here or make a donation to the artist on his website? I would fucking do that in a heartbeat.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very interesting how, you know, across categories, just less and less goes to the people who make the content and more to the people who own the platform on which the content is distributed. And that is the like new star is the people who make the platforms.
Yes, but then, you know, and then there's a backlash that happens on the other end if creators, and I'm thinking more now in terms of musicians and artists, not so much writers like myself, but if they choose to work with like a brand, you know, if they choose to like make an album that's put out by Converse, or they choose to like, you know, do something with Red Bull, or there's a couple of brands that you associate with like paying creators directly, then their fans are like, oh, you're such a sellout. And I think that like, you know, the avenues for make, Astra Taylor wrote a great book about this last year that I felt was poorly marketed, but it's a really great read on this topic called The People's Platform that I recommend.
Jay-Z and Samsung, also another.
Yeah
going
exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, then it's just all on the artist to sort of say, okay, like which brand am I going to get to pay me, because I don't get paid for the actual work. I get paid for being you know, a brand in and of myself.
And so much so that these brand, these celebrities now want to own the platforms and are, you know, are getting into tech at very quick, you know, very quickly. Ludacris just became an investor.
Oh my God. Incredible. What has Ludacris invested in?
A startup in Atlanta. This is in a TechCrunch article yesterday. I think it's Uber for something.
Ubacris. Oh my God. great. I mean, like, yeah, like it makes sense, right? That you would be investing in, if I were an artist in that vein, I would probably be thinking along the same lines. You see it with celebrities. I mean, the goopification of every, like actor who, I mean, actresses in particular, I see that, like, you know, Reese Witherspoon is now directly selling stuff and, you know, and Gwyneth and who, there's a couple other examples that, that are kind of along the same lines.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I mean, when I talk to people who are, you know, thriving in tech and don't feel conflicted about some of this, I mean, I think a lot of it's really good and really, I'm generally net excited about it. But when people aren't conflicted, I'm like, man, maybe you're just not thinking deep enough or like, I don't know how you could not be.
Right. And my frustration doesn't come in like, you know, I mean, I am not someone who, I mean, I use Spotify and I take Uber and, you know, that's definitely true. But I mean, I think there are a lot of people like me who, despite feeling conflicted, continue to do it and would feel a lot better about continuing to do it if I could do it in a way that let me make better choices about how I spend. And you know, there's a lot that technology can do to enable that. It's so funny how many of these places have like transparency as like one of their values. And it's like, you know, actually transparency to whom? Transparency to your users? Not about your metrics, but about like, you know, how they can actually support the artists that they listen to every day or how they can, you know, support the drivers who get them where they need to go. And even saying like, maybe you could encourage tipping instead of discouraging it. That's pretty basic, you know?
Have you seen Patreon?
I have, yeah, which is interesting. I think that the calculus, much like, you know, much like maybe this is where we're all Jay-Z, right? Where the calculus of, huh, am I just asking for money to do my normal job? It's something that I think about a lot. I mean, I thought about asking for donations for my newsletter and for like a lot of different things. And it's... Right. Like I could probably get people to give me some money that way, but is that what I want to do? Do I want to give them something to actually pay for? Do I want to try to sell a product? Is there a, you know, I don't know. There's like a lot of different questions that you have to consider when you're a creator as opposed to when you're a platform. And I think they're way stickier when you are someone who's making stuff.
You know, I'm curious to hear what you think about this. So George Saunders, I'm a big fan of, you know, great writers or story writer. I had this, you know, just a great guy in general, commencement speech about kindness. He doesn't seem to do any, he just seems to like make the work and it's so good that, you know, there's an audience for it, but he doesn't really build an audience online to put it mildly. Are you a fan of any of his work?
Yeah, I am.
And my concern is that when there are a lot of people like that who have amazing stuff and stuff that's, I think, you know, really important for society, when it's not out there enough, it gets supplanted by other things that are maybe not as, like, it almost seems like there's like a war of ideas in some way. Is that a terrible way to think about things?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard because I think that, you know, if you are someone who prefers to be like a more reclusive creator who's not in dialogue with like, you know, like basically if you're not what I described as my working style, kind of being in, you know, as it, the way it's informed by being in touch with people and being part of a conversation in person and with my editors, but also in line, like online more publicly. If that's not how you prefer to work, I think that especially earlier in your career, that's not really an option that you have. I mean, maybe it is an option you have if you are working on, like, if George Saunders is starting his career today and he's working on his novels and not really interacting with anyone on the internet. Possibly, if the novels are great, you know, he can still get them published while he, you know, works in a bank or whatever he needs to do to pay rent. You know, I mean, I don't think it's totally impossible for that to happen. And the world of fiction is a little bit different than the world of nonfiction and of journalism. But yeah, it's still possible. Is it harder in different ways? Yes. Like, is it harder to make a full-time living off of your art if you don't engage in anything digital? Probably. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I'm curious, though, if you if you think of it as, is there any social responsibility to it?
In a way of like, do I feel responsible to interact about my work, or like, should George Saunders be online talking about it? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, either or, you know, do you feel writers or artists have, you know, what does the sense of social responsibility play into your work, into promoting your work, or let's take the Saunders example as well.
I mean, I think it's a little bit different again for like, for people who are writing about social issues in a more explicit way, who are writing nonfiction like I am. I think it would be really weird if you took the kind of stuff that I write about and the kind of reporting I do and sort of had me do it in like a 1970s style where I'm not looking at the internet. I'm like calling people and writing, you know, disconnected from that conversation. That would be really weird, I think. Some people do it, and that's why some magazines read so stilted and out of date. But most of us, you know, like who are interacting with the world, do that. I think with fiction, it's a little bit different. In some ways, maybe it's a benefit. Like, you know, you're not actually you're writing something that comes from a totally different place or a different world. It's not influenced by, you know, any whims of the public conversation or anything like that. But I don't think that all creators have an obligation to talk about their work and to engage with the people who consume it. I think that that is how I've always preferred to work. And to me, it almost seems silly to try to make work for, you know, for more than just yourself, but not want to talk about it. But that's probably a bias of my own personality.
Underrated or overrated, Jonathan Franzen?
I mean, I don't know. I made it like maybe a third of the way through Freedom. So was that well reviewed? I don't know. It, probably over. I just am not. It's funny. It's like Jonathan Franzen, I should probably give more of a chance. But he's like, you know, he's like on the scale of like Elena Ferrante on fire, everyone's reading it, to like, oh my God, it's like so not cool to read this. He's sort of like, you know, so far on the other end in like the lit circles where I run that I'm probably biased against him in a way that isn't fair either. But I don't know. I didn't make it very far in Freedom, so I'm going to say over.
How about Dave Foster Wallace?
I mean, neither over nor underrated. He is extremely highly rated and it's warranted.
How about the movie?
I haven't seen the movie yet. I have been afraid to watch it after many journalists I know were like, oh my God, this is exactly how it looks when we attempt to profile someone. It's excruciating to watch. And I'm like, oh, I feel embarrassed for myself while doing that kind of profile. I don't know if I can watch Jesse Eisenberg as like my, as a, in that role. So I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. I felt that way too. And then I saw it and I started to like it. And then I felt uncomfortable liking it, knowing all of this and knowing that he would have hated it.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't, would he have hated it? It's not totally clear to me.
Or felt uncomfortable about it, for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that, like, you know, like I was saying earlier about, like, once someone is kind of a semi-public figure, it's really easy to sort of say, oh, David Foster Wallace would love/hate this. And it's like, well, maybe. I don't know. I didn't really know David Foster Wallace, but we'll see.
In terms of effect on feminism in general, over or under Beyonce.
Oh my God, Beyonce is great. Beyonce is like underrated for everything.
Yeah. How about Nicki Minaj?
Oh, underrated as a feminist influence. Did you listen to her VMA speech? It was great.
What do people not understand when they say that she's like a negative symbol or something?
Well, I think that there is a sort of strain of feminism that is mostly but not exclusively associated with you know, the sort of 70s, 80s era of the second wave that is like, well, because Nicki Minaj is like, you know, on stage in a thong and talking about her ass a lot, then she's probably not a great feminist icon. Whereas a more modern feminist sensibility would say, you know, she pretty much owns exactly the way her body is portrayed. And she has lots of great messages about owning your own destiny. And is a self-made woman of color who refuses to apologize for that, which are all incredibly feminist things. So I don't know. I don't think that in many modern feminist contexts, it would not be, you know, she would not be underrated. But like perhaps in the culture at large or by other generations of feminists, she would be.
Lena Dunham.
I'm kind of down the middle on Lena Dunham. Yeah, like I think that I want there to be a million more Lena Dunhams. I think like I think it is awesome the way she has charted like a course for her career by creating exactly what she wants to create. and not everything she's made has totally resonated with me personally, but also that is not the criteria by which I like to judge, particularly like other self-made women.
Cheryl Strayed.
Oh, I love Cheryl Strayed. I don't even know where to put her in the over-under because I'm not sure where the public opinion rates her, but I think she's fantastic.
Sheryl Sandberg.
I'm also kind of down the middle on Sheryl Sandberg. I mean, I think that there is, within the kind of corporate trappings of Lean In, calls for more and more meaningful feminist reforms. But you know, I mean, I struggle at the end of the day. It's sort of in a way, like it feels like Dove campaign for real beauty stuff where I'm like, I support what you're doing. Like I support the sort of like, I'm glad you are carrying this message, but I still think that there's probably a more radical version of it that would align better with my politics. But I'm glad she's saying what she's saying and doing what she's doing. And I think, you know, she's someone who is probably listening and probably open to pushes to do it even better.
Under, over in terms of impact on society, Tinder.
I'm like also right down the middle on Tinder. Like I think that like, I don't actually think that it has, you know, created any dynamics that didn't already exist.
Elon Musk.
I don't know. I mean, I'm obviously like not, you know, a fangirl. Like I'm not like, oh my God. I'm glad he's also doing what he's doing. I did an interview a year and a half ago, maybe with, Gwynne Shotwell, who's the president of SpaceX and who's kind of making that stuff run every single day while he is being like a moonshotting thought leader, whatever. And she is incredible. And by mere fact of like, you know, he made her the president of that company. I'm like, good job. So I don't know. I mean, again, I'm sort of like, you know, great. Glad he's doing what he's doing, but I'm not like, I'm not dying for it. You know,
polyamory. Is that going to become a mainstream thing?
Oh my God. San Francisco loves polyamory. It's so funny. Cause, actually I know a couple of couples who, have been together a long time and who sort of have made various non-monogamous situations work for them well. And I sort of am always casually looking for the commonalities between those couples and haven't found them. I would love someone to write a book about this. I think often it's used as an excuse to just like fuck around on people. I don't think it always is. I think sometimes it's like a really cool tool to have in your arsenal as you're trying to like make meaningful relationships of various kinds. And I think probably some people are too quick to write it off, but other people are like abuse the term to just do whatever the fuck they want. But I don't know. The couples I know who have made it work for them long term, and they are some of my top tier aspirational couple friends. So who knows?
That would also be a fascinating podcast.
Yeah, you should do that one too.
Call your polyamorous grandma, perhaps.
Call your girlfriends.
Yes, that's good. That's good. Because I just saw an Intelligence Squared debate on this porn.
I mean, again, same. I feel like porn is like neither like great nor porn is, you know what I mean? It's like sex is, porn is. That's my feeling.
I just spoke with someone who is trying to make porn more realistic, I guess. She's porn, the porn is great, but the porn that's displayed makes men do all sorts of negative things, is, I guess, where she came down on it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that like, I don't know. I think that it really, the universe of porn is vast, and depending on what you choose to watch, maybe it already looks pretty close to the sex that you were having as a real person. And, you know, on the other end, maybe it looks like sex that no heterosexual woman would ever want to have, ever. I don't know. I mean, I think that you can make a lot of choices that either do reflect or don't reflect what a lot of real humans would want to do in a real life context. And it seems weird. I don't know. I mean, I think that if there's a woman who's making porn that fits what she thinks more women would want, that's awesome. I support her. I'm for more options in all things. And I think there are probably some types of porn. If you told me like, hey, Anne, like this guy you're about to start dating only watches this constantly, I would be like, okay, well, I don't know. You know what I mean? But like, you know, just like the basic fact of porn is like not, I don't know, is not cause for like alarm or applause.
Gotcha. Last two questions. When you think of the term fulfilled or fulfillment, who comes to mind and why?
Who? Like someone in my own life?
Someone in your life that you know or someone that you follow on Twitter, just someone more broadly who you feel is as fulfilled or successful in the way that you want to be successful?
Oh, that's really interesting. This is a hard one. I mean, I think that I know a lot of people who have got like a pretty great situation, but are still striving, if that makes sense. And I would put myself in that category too. I don't know too many people who I would say are just like fulfilled, full stop. It's great. We can put it on autopilot. And I think part of being a fulfilled person is continuing to work toward things and continuing to feel like you're building towards something better. And I really hope that that is something that act, that sort of like that slightly not fulfilledness, that's not even a word, that is something that I am able to maintain throughout my life, no matter how long it is.
Yeah. And last question I ask everyone who comes on, what are your thoughts on funerals more broadly? I don't ask that part. The second part, which I do ask, is what do you want people to say at yours?
Oh, man. Well, this is very timely because I finally, after saying I was going to do it forever, set up my like Gmail inactivity thing, which is basically the Gmail in case I die, like backstop. And so I definitely had to think about like, how many months after I'm dead do I want people to read my email? And I settled on a year. But so no one will be reading any of my mean emails aloud at my funeral. But my ideal situation for my funeral is that all these people who are really important to me show up and they all know each other already. They're all like, oh yeah, I heard Anne tell that story about you. Or like they're already friends or I don't know. I think that the best thing that you can do for people sometimes is to introduce them to other great people you know and to just be a link. You know, I mean, I take great, great pleasure in linking people. And so maybe it's just a reunion rather than like a sad event.
That's interesting. So people can remember you and they also know you. Wow, that is really interesting.
So they're like, I'm sad Anne is dead, but we have our friendship. And like, that's a thing that she did. And even though I'm dead, they're going to keep being friends because they're both alive or whatever. That thought makes me feel awesome.
That's one of my favorite answers to this question.
Awesome.
Cool. Anne, thank you for taking all this time on a Friday. And it was a fantastic chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me.
Where can, fascinated people, startup bros, grandmas, where can everyone find you online?
Also startup grandmas, please.
Yes, like, absolutely. Yeah.
I would really like to be reaching them. Everything is at annefriedman.com. And you can get everywhere from there.
And is there any last minute plugs of things that are upcoming or things we should, audience should look out for?
I mean, no, just listen. You can listen to my podcast. If you listen to this podcast, you probably like other podcasts.
Yes, Call Your Girlfriend.
But yeah, that's about it.
If they're to start with one episode of Call Your Girlfriend, is there a favorite or should they start from the beginning?
You know, the one from last week is actually pretty great. The title is Low Key Creep. I believe it's episode 33. I think you could start there and work your way backwards.
Excellent. Cool, Anne. Have a great weekend and great to chat with you.
Okay, thanks. You too.